Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today is Wednesday, February 24th, 2021. And with me today is Senator L.V. Gray Jackson. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome.
Senator Stevens, welcome.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Senator Holland is here with us today. And I am Senator Mia Costello. Senator Rivak will be here shortly. Today we have two bills on the agenda. The first is Senate Bill 54, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation Water and Sewer Bonds and Transportation Bill. This is the governor's bill introduced on his behalf, and it's the first hearing in Labor and Commerce. So today we will have invited testimony, and then we will take questions from committee members and then hold the bill for further consideration. The second bill on today's schedule is Senate Bill 86, which is a temporary permits and licenses bill. This is a committee bill. Essentially what we did was when the governor introduced his disaster declaration, we felt that the issues in the bill needed further discussion, and so it is one of a host of bills that were taken out of the emergency declaration, and we will be having my staff member introduce a sectional, and then the administration essentially will explain or answer questions about temporary licenses and the need or perhaps no more need for those. Welcome, Senator Rivak.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Carrie and Doug for your assistance today, and also my committee aide, Melody, and my other aide, Katie, is going to be on the line for the second bill today. So with that, I wanted to welcome Brian Butcher, who's the Executive Director and CEO of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, who's online with other individuals from the corporation. And Brian, please feel free to introduce yourself and introduce the bill. I'd also ask that, anyone who does call or testify for the committee, just please mention where you're calling from. So thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, CEO, Executive Director of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. I have with us our Chief Financial Officer, Mike Strand, as well as our Director of Governmental Relations, Stacey Barnes. And I have a short it's a fairly simple bill, but I have a short PowerPoint to go through. I don't know if there's somebody there that's got it that can change the pages for me or how this will work.
Okay, we'll take a brief at ease. Commerce Committee. So with that, Brian, if you could go ahead and begin your presentation, and we'll have Melody go through so that we can view it also on the screen. So thank you, Melody.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Briefly, this bill would authorize the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to sell $101.63 million of tax-exempt capital project bonds that would allow for funding of projects in the state capital budget. And then the debt service for that would be paid through AHFC's dividend to the state. So I have a few slides that we'll walk through. We have our mission to provide Alaskans access to safe, quality, affordable housing.
Brian, if I can ask you to just slow down a little bit, if that's okay. Thank you.
Sure. So I'll start on slide three, which is just a brief introduction to what AHFC does for the benefit of the committee. We have approximately 20% of the home mortgages in the state. Our kind of niche is first-time home buyers, veterans, and rural, although we do them all over the state, and that's how we produce the funds that pay for AHFC's operating budget as well as the federal funds that come in. We run the state's public housing, which is approximately 1,600 units in 15 different communities in the state, as well as 5,000 to 6,000 housing choice vouchers, where a qualified Alaskan can get a voucher for an apartment in the community in which they live, and that's all public housing is federal programs. That's all run by HFC for HUD. We're also in charge of energy efficiency and energy codes for the state of Alaska, and we administer a number of grants and federal tax credits that help for the building of affordable housing, homelessness, and senior housing, and numerous other programs of benefit to the state. We're legally separate from the state, so as a result, we have our own credit rating, and which is currently AA+. And as a result of that, we issue our own bonds, and the debt of the corporation is not the debt of the state. So they are legally separate.
Senator
Moving
Stevens?
Moving on to slide 4.
Oh, Brian, we have a question from Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Ms. Butcher. So you mentioned, I must have missed that, public housing, you said there are 1,600. Is that apartments or is that complexes? What is that 1,600?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, those are apartments.
Apartments.
And
thank
they
you.
Were primarily built in the 70s and 80s when HUD's MO for dealing with folks that needed help in public housing were to build housing, apartment buildings. You might be aware of the large 50 and 60 story buildings, the public housing that people think of it in some of the larger cities like Chicago and New York. So we still run and own those units. And then we also do all of the vouchers, which was kind of about 30 years ago, they decided to change the way they administered public housing nationwide to rather to have them in apartments run by private landlords than to have them deal with the stigma of living in public housing.
Well, thank you. Then do you assist private enterprise, private people going into building low-cost housing? Is that under your purview as well?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, yes, it is. Most of the funds from that come from federal low-income housing tax credits that we administer for the state and allows the funds necessary to kind of buy down, as it were, for developments to happen across the state to be able to rent to lower-income Alaskans.
Great, great. Thank you, Brian.
Okay, Madam Chair, on to slide 4. This gives you a snapshot of how the HFC dividend has been paid over the last decade. As some of you may know, the dividend plan for HFC's transfer of dividends to the state of Alaska is in state statute, and it is 75% of our net income each year annually is paid to the state of Alaska. So we saw large dividends 20 years ago, and it began to drop right after the 2008-2009 recession, when artificially low interest rates reduced the portfolio the state has, or HFC has, and as you can see, it's built back up. So we dropped to a low of a $7 million dividend in FY15, and we've been up over $40 million as a dividend to the state for the last two fiscal years. And our cumulative dividends over the last 25 years has been a little over $2 billion paid to the state. Slide 5 talks about some of the bonding history the corporation has done on behalf of the state. As you can see, it was when the dividends were larger in the late 90s and early 2000s. We did quite a bit of activity exactly like what we're bringing here in this bill today, where we would go to the legislature, they would authorize us to sell tax-exempt state capital project bonds, and those funds would then be used in the state capital budget to pay for what you'd consider traditional state capital projects, which are roads, buildings, ports, harbors, village safe water projects, any of the things that the IRS would say qualified for tax-exempt debt, which is getting a little bit lower interest rate for our bonds than you would for a normal taxable bond deal. Slide 6, Madam Chair, are the capital projects to be administered by the Departments of Environmental Conservation and Transportation and Public Facilities. These are in the state capital budget, so as this bill moves along, as well as the state capital budget, the name of the projects and the amounts for the projects need to match to make sure that what AHFC sells in bonds and finances is authorized through the state capital budget to be expended and spent. Slide 7, again, emphasizes that these bonds that we sell will of Alaska will not have a credit impact on the state and will not have a financial obligation in the, of the state. The corporation would have that obligation to pay once the bonds are sold, and repayment of the bonds would be offset by future AHFC dividends. At this time, we estimate the interest rates for the bonds would be between 2 and 3%, historically low. There's never been a better time to be in the market to sell bonds like these than right now. And we're also looking at probably 20-year bonds. So the and you can see it in our fiscal note, the payback debt service would be somewhere between $6 and $7 million. We won't know until if the bill is passed. We would then go to the market sometime probably early in the summer. In all likelihood, the interest rates will still be very low. Nobody has an expectation that they're going to go up considerably in the next 6 months. But at that time, we would be able to report back exactly how the bond deal was structured, what the interest rate was, and then what the annual debt service payments for the bonds to be taken out of the dividend will be into the future.
Thank you, Director Butcher. I think we have a question from Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. So my question is, the debt service is $6 million annually for 20 years? Is that what I thought I heard you say?
Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson, yes. We don't know the exact amount right now, but the estimate is it would be somewhere between $6 and $7 million a year.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Seeing no other questions, Director Butcher, thanks for your presentation. Chair Costello, Madam Chair, will be back shortly. We're going to take a quick at ease.
Welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, and thank you, Brian, for giving the presentation. I had just one quick question about the list of projects on slide 6. Is it possible for the committee to get a more of a breakdown of if there are actual individual projects associated with each one of these, if they've been identified yet? And how did you determine, other than being eligible for the no interest rate, I mean, were there other capital projects that could be included in this list?
Madam Chair, when we kind of talked about the idea with the governor's office, they made the decision on where the particular projects were going. I think based on what easily qualified as capital projects to sell tax-exempt debt, the IRS requires a fairly strict definition of what you can spend on, which is basically projects that would have a longevity or a duration of life longer than the bonds. So as an example, you wouldn't be able to qualify to buy computers with this because the life of it would be much shorter. So our only role in it is running it through our bond and tax council to make sure that what the state considers would be qualified so we could sell tax-exempt debt. That being said, any project that fit under that criteria could potentially be used under this. So I think we have people from DOT and DEC that are on the line that can probably give you a little bit more detail about the project.
Okay. Thank you. And who did you mention would be online to help with that?
DOT and...
Oh, okay. Rob Carpenter.
Can you hear me, Madam?
Yes, we can hear you, Rob.
Oh, thanks, Madam Chair. Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner, DOT. The projects that we have listed in the bill are the match components for our two federal highway program, or I'm sorry, our two federal aid programs, the Federal Highway Administration and the Federal Aviation Administration. These are, our two large capital programs in our capital budget. We receive approximately $600 million a year from the Federal Highway Administration and another almost $200 million a year from the Federal Aviation Administration. And these two chunks of money in this bond bill would provide the match. We're required to have roughly 9% match for our federal highway program and 6.25% match for our federal aviation program. The projects themselves that are in those programs are supported by the planning documents that are required by the federal government. You've probably heard of the STIP, or the Surface the Statewide Transportation Improvement Plan, which is a federally required planning document for mapping out over 4 years the projects that are planned and the phases of each project going forward for all our highway construction. And similarly, we have an AIP, Airport Improvement Plan, for our federal aviation program, which again lists out the projects and the timeline over a time span. And we have both those documents available. We can provide them to the committee. They're quite extensive and not super easy to read, but we're happy to provide them to the committee.
Okay, thank you. And I did want to mention that I've had some constituents who are familiar with rural airports in Alaska, and I know it sounds like these are construction projects, but the maintenance of our rural airports is a concern, and perhaps at some point DOT could meet with me in my office and just give me an update on the contracts that you have in the local communities and what you do to ensure that our airports are safe for the folks who fly in and out, who are delivering important goods to the rural community. So thank you, Rob. I appreciate you being online. Are there questions of other members? Commissioner. Hey. Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification, too, I'm familiar with the STIP and the AIP. So the majority of the bond, the money that we're asking for is to cover the match for FHA and then FAA. So my question is, and it's probably relative to the question that our chair had, I know we can go online and look at all the projects for the STIP, but I'd like a little more detail on what projects are included in both the match for the STIP and the AIP, if that's possible. Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And could somebody online just respond to Senator Gray Jackson, just so if you have any questions about what she's asking for?
Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson's Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner with DOT. We will supply you the documents that support the projects that match in this bill. So we'll get a hold of your office. We'll get it all for the committee to understand.
I think that would be great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I'm not sure who could answer this question. Perhaps Ruth Kostick, who's online. So Brian Butcher had mentioned that this is a way to fund projects in our capital budget currently, so that if this bill were to pass, then the $101.63 million would come out of the capital budget. Is there a must-have date or passage timeline for this in relation to the capital budget? Does this have to pass first, or if the capital budget passes and then this passes, would there be some language that would address that this these particular four projects are being handled in legislation or through the bonding?
For the record, Ruth Kostick, Administrative Services Director for the Department of Environmental Conservation. I'm not sure that I'm the best one to answer this question, but it is my understanding that that both the projects stay in the capital budget and the bond bill passes separately. They don't come out of the capital budget if the bond bill passes.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Stevens did have a question. Senator Stevens.
No questions.
Nope. Okay. Any other questions of members? Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to start off by saying that I'm really, really happy to see this bond because it's going to enable us to receive a lot of money from the federal government. So I really appreciate this. And my question, though, is are any other projects shovel ready? And maybe you'll be able to answer that when you send the list of projects. And also, when do you think the projects may go out to bid? And if you want to wait to answer these questions when you send us a list of projects, I'm fine with that. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chairman, would you like me to respond?
I'm sorry, I was talking to my aide. was that Rob?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you have a comment?
Oh, I was going to just respond to Senator Gray Jackson's request there. We, you know, our STIP, again, the Statewide Transportation Improvement Plan has projects in many phases. A lot are shovel ready and going out this summer to bid. And then there's various other stages of planning, right away, design, et cetera. So it's quite a large list. Like we mentioned, we obligate around $600-700 million a year, and many of it, much of it's for construction, but a lot of it's for other phases of development as well. But we'll get more details for you.
Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you very much. What I'd really like to see, if possible, more than anything, is what projects are shovel ready. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And then are there any further questions? Okay, seeing none, I want to thank everyone who was online, including Laurel Shoup and Stacey Barnes, Mike Strand, Rob, thank you, and of course Brian Butcher and also Ruth Kostick. Appreciate you being available to answer the questions of the committee. We are going to be holding this bill for further consideration, and if the materials could be sent to my office, I could then pass those on to everyone in the committee. So thank you. We are going to take a brief at ease as we set up the computer and the PowerPoint for the next bill, which is Senate Bill 86, Temporary Permits and Licenses. Okay, welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Next is Senate Bill 86, the Temporary Permits and Licenses, and my aide, Katie McCall, is here in the room via Zoom or Teams to walk us through the sectional, and then Sarah Chambers, who's the director of the Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing, is online to take questions. The intent is to hold this bill for further consideration. So, Katie, welcome, and thank you for going through the sectional on this bill and explaining why we do have this bill in front of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
All right. So for the record, my name is Katie McCall, staff to Senator Costello. Madam Chair, if it's all right with you, I could briefly read the sponsor statement just to give the committee an overview of what this bill is and what it accomplishes.
Katie, that would be great. Thank you.
All right. So Senate Bill 86 adapts language originally found in Senate Bill 56, the governor's public health disaster emergency bill, by providing a means to issue temporary licenses, permits, and certificates under statutory law. The distinction between Senate Bill 86 and Senate Bill 56 is that the governor's bill only amended uncodified law to allow for expedited licensing during the novel coronavirus disease public health disaster emergency. By placing a temporary licensing process in statute, our state laws become more COVID-19 aware, and the state has the means to maintain operations during times of unprecedented need, even when a disaster emergency declaration is not in place. So the reason this bill is before the committee today is to highlight whether or not the legislature really wants to put a provision such as this in statute instead of in uncodified law. And with that, I will walk through the sectional analysis. I would say briefly, but it is a little lengthy, so feel free to stop me at any time if you have any questions.
Katie, Senator Stevens has a question for you.
So, Katie, I guess the question I have is why? Why are we doing this? A disaster declaration solves all of these problems. Why are we not doing a disaster declaration? Why are we going around trying to figure out all the things we don't know about? And I'll just add to that that I've just discovered that there are many rules, some 15, that the that our school districts would have to find somewhere that that put this in some kind of a regulation as well. So I guess my question to you, I don't know if you can answer this, is why are we doing this uncodified law business when a disaster declaration would be so simple and do the same thing?
So, Katie, I can go ahead and answer that for Senator Stevens. So, Senator Stevens, as you remember, when we first arrived in Juneau, we had Senate Bill 56 in front of us. The questions that many of us had for the administration were voluminous. The bill dealt with a lot of topics, including online gaming and the ability to, provide assistance to nonprofits online. It had the temporary licensure in it. It had a fingerprinting section. And as we were grappling with this, we were looking at an impending deadline of, I think it was February 14th, that a new disaster, in order to extend the declaration. What the Senate chose to do, as you know, is we instead passed a resolution, which the governor at the time had asked for, asking him to declare a new declaration. As you know, the governor is the only person who can declare a disaster. After that was passed and the House at the time was unorganized, they passed a letter, wrote a letter. The governor chose instead not to issue a disaster declaration. In the meantime, we wanted to be very quick and thorough at the same time, and so we have introduced several committee bills that will come before us. This is one of them, and so the question is, can the administration give us a rationale for why we would have a temporary license? What licenses they actually gave? Is the public, protected in the temporary licenses? And is it something that we want to do? Do we want to put a sunset date on it? So rather than just giving the broad power of the ability to ignore every regulation and every state law, this approach, we offered the governor the one option and he chose not to declare it. So now we are going through in a deliberative process with the different agencies, coming before us to answer those questions. And, whether or not this is the best approach, it remains to be seen. But I do have to say that when you look at the content matter of all the different bills that we now have in the process, including fingerprinting, online gaming, licensure, we also have Senate Bill 24, which is ready, to go to the floor, which was also in the governor's bill. This is just a more deliberative process where, we'll have the opportunity to ask Sarah Chambers and others, do we still need this? What are the problems that we're seeing? Why did we need it to begin with, and how was it used? And I'm actually really excited to have some of those questions answered. So that's kind of the background on it. And, it's for the committee to decide. And this bill was essentially, taken out of that bill, which did not have time to pass the Senate. And that was in the language of the resolution and the findings where we said, within a few weeks, we can't essentially look into all these issues and determine whether or not we could pass that bill. But we did recognize that many of the issues in the disaster declaration did not rise to the level of needing a disaster declaration. Many of them are just making our statutes COVID aware. For example, the online charitable gaming. So, for example, Boys and Girls Clubs, nonprofits like that, they no longer have the ability to have in-person events where they raise money. So what they're looking for is an ability to do that, online. And so we've sectioned these out. Most of them come to this committee. And, if we have a better route, I'm open to suggestions. So that's the short answer, Senator Stevens.
Well, my concern is that we don't know what we don't know. And I just found out yesterday there are 15 rules that were covered under the disaster declaration in education that would have to find somewhere. We're going to have to find a way to put those into uncodified law. And what are we missing out there? Are we going to find out that there are some things that are missing that we're not covering under that we would have covered under a disaster declaration that are not being covered under these uncodified laws? For example, in education, finding out that many of our districts have been hiring teachers without a certification. This is not in this bill, but it should be in some bill if we seriously are going to try to find every possible issue that could have been affected by the disaster declaration, but is now not going to be affected because we haven't declared that.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. And the governor chose not to declare a disaster, and he's the one who oversees all of those departments. So we're willing to work with the administration on a path forward. So with that, Katie, if you could walk us through the sectional.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, this is Katie McCall, staff to Senator Costello. So Senate Bill 86, Temporary Permits and Licenses, Section 1, found on pages 1 and 2, repeals current statutory language establishing temporary courtesy licenses for non-residents. Subsection A contains new language establishing that the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development has the ability to issue a temporary license, permit, or certificate to an individual who holds a corresponding license, permit, or certificate in another jurisdiction. Subsection B establishes that a temporary license, permit, or certificate is valid for 1 year and allows the license, permit, or certificate holder to temporarily practice the occupation for which it was granted. Section 2, found on page 2, removes temporary license from this section and renumbers subsections accordingly. Section 3, found on page 2, amends subsections 1, 6, 7, and 8 by removing temporary permit from each subsection. It amends these same subsections by adding language specifying that a temporary license is issued under AS 0801062, adds temporary supervised practice license to these same subsections. And briefly, I want to explain, if I can, Madam Chair, about why that language, temporary supervised practice license, is added in there. And I apologize, I don't have things printed, so I'll have to search through some tabs to find it. There is a legal memo that explains that, if you would like me to expand a little bit.
Please feel free to do that, Katie.
Okay. Just one moment. Okay, so the section of that memo, under current law, a person who's applied to take the examination for a license to practice as a barber or a hairdresser is eligible to receive a temporary license under AS 0813175 so long as the person works under the supervision of a licensee. Similarly, veterinary applicants awaiting examination results are eligible to receive a temporary license under AS 0898180 if they practice under supervision. The bill changes the name of these licenses to temporary supervised practice license. So there are quite a few sections that change that language, and that is the reasoning behind that. I just wanted to clarify.
Thank you, Katie.
And I will continue with the sectional. Okay, so section 4 on page 3 is amended by removing or temporary permit from this section. It also adds language specifying that a temporary license is issued under AS0801062 and adds temporary supervised practice license to this section. Section 5 on page 3 is amended by removing or temporary permit for this section from this section, adds language specifying that a temporary license is issued under AS0801062 and adds temporary supervised practice license to this section. Section 6, found on page 3, changes the title of this section from temporary license to temporary supervised practice license and removes B temporarily licensed from this section and replaces it with receive a temporary supervised practice license, as well as inserts language to specify that each temporary practice license listed in this section is a temporary supervised practice license. Section 7, found on page 4, removes temporary permit from subsection A12 and renumbers subsections accordingly. It also inserts language to specify that a temporary license listed under this section is a temporary supervised practice license. Section 8, found on page 5, amends subsections A and B by removing temporary permit from those subsections. It adds language to subsections A and B specifying that a temporary license is issued under AS0801062 and adds temporary supervised practice license to those subsections. Section 9, found on page 5, is amended by removing language pertaining to the issuance of a temporary permit and a locum tenens permit under this section. Section 10, found on page 5, removes AS0836254 as an exception to the provision that a person may not practice or attempt to practice dentistry without a license. Section 11, found on page 5, changes the title of this subsection by inserting the word practice. It also inserts language to specify that a temporary license listed under this section is a temporary practice license. Section 12, found on page 6, is amended by removing language pertaining to a temporary permit for locum tenens practice. Section 13, found on page 6, removes subsection 4, temporary permit, and subsection 5, locum tenens permit, and renumbers subsections accordingly. Section 14, found on page 6, removes temporary permit from subsections 1, 2, and 3. Section 15, found on page 7, removes subsection 5, temporary license, and subsection 8, emergency permit, and renumbers subsections accordingly. Section 16, found on page 7, is amended by removing the issuance of temporary permits from the State Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy Board. Section 17, found on page 8, is amended to remove subsection 5, temporary permit, and subsection 6, limited permit. Section 18, found on page 8, is amended by replacing the word limited in subsections A3 and B4 with the word temporary. The statute referenced in those same subsections is replaced with AS0801062. Section 19, found on page 9, is amended by replacing the statute referenced in subsection A with AS0801062. Section 20, found on page 10, changes the title of this section from temporary license to temporary supervised practice license and removes B temporarily licensed from this section and replaces it with receive a temporary supervised practice license. It also inserts language to specify that a temporary license described in this section is a temporary supervised practice license. Section 21, found on page 10, inserts language specifying that a temporary license listed in this section is a temporary supervised practice license. It also removes subsection 7, temporary permit. Section 22, found on page 10, lists the sections that will be repealed as a result of this act. And section 23, found on page 10, establishes an effective date of January 1st, 2022. And that concludes the sectional analysis.
thank you, Katie. I appreciate you going through it, and I appreciate you putting together the sectional for this bill. It's my intention now to have Sarah Chambers, who's the director of the Division of Corporations Business and Professional Licensing, comment on the bill, and I have several questions for you, Sarah, but first I wanted to see if members have questions. Senator Gray Jackson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my first question is, and I know it's being removed, but what is a locum tenens permit? I have no idea. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I can get an answer for you in just a second. Let me find it.
So, Senator Gray Jackson, let's have Sarah Chambers take that and also provide. Sarah, what I'm interested in knowing is during the last year, during the disaster declaration, the division was able to provide expedited licenses and address the COVID situation. And I would be curious to hear from you how you did that, which professions we saw most of the regulations being put aside for expediency's sake, and whether or not there are any professions in Alaska that already have in statute an expedited process. So, for example, the military spouses, I know we've passed legislation to expedite their licenses. I would be interested in whether nurses have that ability, and if there's any others that that already exist in statute where the state has the ability to expedite the providing of those licenses.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. I'm happy to answer Senator Gray Jackson's question first, if you'd like.
That's great. Thanks.
Thank you. Through the Chair, Senator Gray Jackson, a locum tenens license is a name for a very temporary, specific license that allows someone to come in from out of state and work for a limited fixed period of time for a profession, usually within nursing or medical. Sometimes they're referred to as travelers. So you may have heard of like traveling nurses.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Sarah. Did you want to respond to my questions? And then we have a question from Senator Rivak.
Sure. Thank you. Madam Chair, you have quite a bit of data that would need to be provided in a full answer to your question, but I sense where you're going. And so we do have, with our 43 different professional licensing programs, over 200 types of licenses. Most half of those are governed by boards and half by the department. So we have a variety of different types of licenses, from what we think of as sort of a permanent license, a two-year license, a full license, all the way to something along the lines of a locum tenens or a temporary license or even an emergency courtesy license. So there are a variety of types of licenses, and they all differ according to the licensing program and the governance decisions of the board that oversees them. So we can get that information for you. I wanted to clarify that some of the terms that are used in sort of the speeding up of licensure are not interchangeable. So, for example, expediting just means moving it forward quickly. It doesn't mean that we are changing any of the requirements. They still would need to meet all of the requirements in statute and regulation. And so, for example, military spouses, several years ago, the legislature required expedited handling of military spouse licenses, and we do that. We call it putting it at the front of the line, so we move it quickly. But there hasn't been an effort to or a concerted effort on the parts of our boards to adopt the temporary licensing provisions and that they are allowed to in ASO 801062 that's currently on the books. And so so there isn't a special pathway for military spouses in most of the professions. So the language in the committee's bill is actually very similar to SB 157, which the governor introduced last year, that really spoke to the need to allow people who are qualified in their profession in other jurisdictions who have no restrictions on their license, you know, they have no restricted suspensions or probations. They're fully qualified people to come in and start working while they're finishing up their Alaska requirements. So the language in this bill is actually very, very similar to that bill that was introduced last year, and if it had been passed by the legislature last year, would have been one of the tools that could have helped us manage the COVID situation a little bit better without any sort of emergency action. But here we are looking at this today and looking at other options as well to try to amend our licensing practice to be responsive to the needs of our healthcare system and the needs of our military.
Senator Rivak?
Yes, thank you, Ms. Chambers. I'm curious. I'm curious because in the Joint Armed Services Committee last year and in several of the conversations with the folks, with our great folks that represent our military branches here in the state, their number one issue that came up over and over again with me was licensure. And so I'm curious, are we talking about a difference between temporary license and license expedition to get a state license to practice? I guess before you answer, I just spoke with some folks from DOD today, and it's still a great concern for them. They said nationally the average is 10 months to wait for an expedited license, and certainly Alaska isn't one of the better ones in terms of expedited licensing. And so are those two different things, is the temporary license versus an expedited actual state license?
Through the chair, Senator Rivak, you're asking some excellent questions. And yes, so expedited licensure would just mean to move it through quickly, put them at the front of the line. A temporary license or another type of license, which is allowed in statute or regulation to change the license requirements, to offer a license, as this bill does, to someone who meets certain standards that maybe are slightly different than what is in state law right now. And we are working very closely. We have been working very closely with DOD and our military communities for the last several years, particularly up in Fairbanks with the Eielson expansion, to try to find the opportunities for statute to be changed so we can finally move this forward. And as I mentioned, the governor had several bills last year. We have the Nurse Licensure Compact this year, and certainly the bill in front of you would be a big step forward to help us to have the tools to legally allow this type of license to be issued. We can't, we as a department can't do it without the legislature's giving us the authority, and our boards may have the authority to do it, but they haven't done that yet. So this would actually shift the ability from our boards to the department, which actually could save many, many weeks, up to a couple of months of the time that it might take for the boards to analyze, review, and vote on a license, as many of them have to do now.
Senator Rivak?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that, and I appreciate that you brought up Eielson. I know I've heard recently from folks in DOD that they're concerned about the number of families that are electing not to come to Alaska for several different reasons, but one of them that they mentioned was licensure. And so I was wondering, I guess the question is maybe if we could get how long on average does it take to process these out-of-state licenses. Is that something that if the chair would be so kind. Maybe you could present us with, an average time that it takes for occupational licenses, maybe how long it takes to expedite the expedited ones, how long it takes without expedited ones, and maybe the time it would take for temporary licenses. Could you provide some of that information to us?
Through the chair, Senator Rivak, yes, that's we can work on pulling that together. I can tell you very generally, because again, every license type is going to have a different amount of time because they're all governed separately in statute and regulation. But generally speaking, our full licensing, the problem that we have that is the widely recognized problem that we've I've testified to in many committees over the last several years, and are working with DOD and others to try to address are the requirements. The problem is not with the agency's review. The problem is with the number of requirements, the level of requirements, and that's where we get bogged down, or the applicant gets bogged down, having to go back to their educational institution and say, "I need certified transcripts to be sent," going back to the hospitals where they've worked and saying, "I need to have hospital privileges sent," some documentation for certain healthcare types of licenses. People can have hundreds of documents that they have to send in, and those are not processes that we control. Those are, of course, in statute and regulation. The review time is where the expediting comes in. Once an application is complete, once the applicant has completed sending all of that information in, which can take weeks, it can take months, again, depending on the sophistication of the requirements of the license, we pull that together and do our internal staff review, and then depending on the board and their requirements, send that to the board for their review, which can, again, take several additional weeks. And the expediting can put them again at the first of the line. So depending on a variety of factors, that could be that could shorten a review from 6 weeks to 2 weeks, for example. But that's on top of the requirement for all of the documents that statute and regulation require. And that's really where the difference between an administrative expediting versus changing, fundamentally looking at the structure of the law like this bill does and saying we need to do it differently because military spouses are still having to line up and meet all of these same requirements. Out-of-state and in-state applicants have the same requirements. There's not a different threshold level for them. And it really the speed at which they pull their application requirements together is in their hands for some of it, and it's out of their hands for others. And for military spouses, when it's in their hands, they're already juggling quite a few different bureaucratic hoops in moving, in dealing with all the military requirements of moving, getting kids set up in schools, looking for a job. So this is another this temporary licensure, putting it in the department's hands and helping us change the structure to give them that chance to get to work while they finish their full licensure is really a fundamental structure change that also transfers over to healthcare and all of the other professions that that have to go through our office for people to be able to get to work.
Very brief follow-up, ma'am.
Senator Rivak.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers. I really appreciate all that, and I really hope that we can, find closure to that issue, not just because of the sacrifices that our military families make for us, but also because of the dollars that we lose in the economy and in local economies that have an economic multiplier, that we lose those federal dollars. And so I think that's an important issue, and I appreciate that. I look forward to working more on this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Rivak. Sarah, I was curious if you could explain to the committee what you did as a division director during COVID that was allowable because of the disaster declaration. So we are hearing, or we did hear from especially the healthcare industry, that this is needed. We need help. We need you to pay attention to this. But we never really heard the specific things that they were accessing because of the COVID disaster declaration. So one of the desires of the legislature is to look at what does the healthcare industry need that perhaps we could provide that would be something that would move us away from having to call a disaster declaration every time we want to use telemedicine or something like that. I'm just curious. I don't really have a good handle on it, and I was wondering if you could give me an example. For example, when there's a disaster declaration, how many nurses came to Alaska? How many temporary licenses were provided? How many locum tenant licenses were provided? Is there a backlog of individuals wanting to be licensed as nurses and they're not able to? Are hospitals having trouble hiring individuals? What is it that you were able to do during the COVID pandemic that people are asking for now? And, you know, one of the things about the disaster declaration, it allows any regulation or state law to be waived. And there's a 14-page list of all of those regulations that were waived. I would like to go through at some point with you which ones dealt with your division and how you maneuvered through that and addressed those challenges.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to the hard work that our department, our division staff, and our boards did in the last year to respond to the COVID disaster, and appreciate the legislature taking the lead with SB 241 last year in declaring the disaster and giving some of those initial tools for us to be able to respond quickly to the ever-changing needs that we had in our healthcare, ever-changing healthcare needs that we are all very aware of during COVID, as well as the economic needs. And many of the tools that were in SB 241 that the governor carried on through with his orders, as well as the suspensions of statute and regulation, at least the ones that pertain to my division that I'm all were elements to assist with the economic downturn that all states took during during COVID. So just to try to back up a little bit, the primary areas that our division with licensing of professionals and with business and business licenses and corporate functions were involved with in SB 241, the legislature's disaster declaration. The first element was the ability for our boards and the department to issue courtesy licenses on an expedited basis. And so that generally gave all of us the opportunity in all of our professions to get people licensed who needed to continue care for Alaskans who couldn't travel any longer. In those early days, as you remember, travel was very restricted all over the nation, all over the world, and people were very concerned about travel, especially those who were immunosuppressed or people who had special critical needs. So the courtesy licensing really opened up an opportunity, particularly for our mental health boards, to help, for example, students who had to come home from college. Their colleges shut down. They came back to Alaska, and they were still needing psychological care, professional counseling care. And it was very important to continue care from the providers who had become familiar with them and who had their trust and knew their file, That's very important in mental health. So we were able to move courtesy licenses quickly for those providers and then be able to ensure that continuity for our Alaskan youth who had to come home during that time. So that's one example of many of the courtesy license provision, that expedited licensing, that also had a bit of the structural change that I mentioned earlier. Another area that was in SB 241 that the governor continued through his orders was a provision to allow physicians, physician assistants, and nurses who were qualified in other states, licensed in other states, to be able to provide limited telehealth to Alaskans without getting a license in Alaska. And this was very important, again, for that short period of time that we're still in, as a means to help the Alaskans who can't travel or who are being advised not to travel because of their illness, their type of illness, who still need to receive care from out-of-state specialty providers that they may not be able to access in Alaska. And so to give you an example of that, we have had Alaskans who would have pre-COVID normally traveled down to, say, Virginia Mason or Swedish Hospital down in Seattle to receive care. They're no longer able to physically travel, or they're being advised not to travel there. And those providers are not licensed in Alaska, so they can't deliver telehealth. They can't deliver health care while that person is in Alaska. And that is what the telemedicine provision under the Emergency Disaster Declaration accomplished, was the ability for them to receive that care over the phone, over video, without the provider being licensed. And so another provision in licensing that affected us was the fingerprinting provision. That just, again, was really important during the early stages of COVID in 2020, when fingerprinters were not rolling fingerprints. You couldn't get a fingerprint because nobody would see you in person. And so we worked through a compact in federally through the Department of Public Safety because of that declaration that helped us to find a way to just push pause on the fingerprints until people were able to get those done in person. And then lastly, the additional area in the disaster declaration, again from the legislature that the governor carried through in his health orders, is the ability for corporations to be able to meet virtually. And that's a statute that is, in my opinion, outdated, that you have to meet in person, and the legislature cured that during COVID, so nonprofits and Native corporations could continue to do their business while they were virtually, as long as they had rules set up for that. And that is something that is still needed. So even though that doesn't have to do with professional licensing, it is within our division, and I wanted to be responsive to your question.
So, thank you, Sarah. And we did pass Senate Bill 24 that Senator Wilson introduced, dealing with corporations being able to meet virtually, and it's sitting in Senate rules. We also have Senate Bill 78, which is a bill that is a committee bill here that deals with telehealth. So again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, we want to be responsive, and so we're taking each of those issues and really taking a look at those. So I appreciate that. Some of this is just making our statutes COVID aware, or almost bringing them into the 21st century. For example, the corporations meeting online. And then others, I think, are like more difficult issues. For example, when you weigh the public health versus the need for getting licenses to people so that they can work, there's a balance there that I think we need to find. So I do appreciate you mentioning all of these issues. So when you talked about how the division was able to meet the needs that you had, you didn't mention hiring more nurses or hiring more doctors, and I'm curious, did you want to comment on that topic? Did we see more nurses come to Alaska, or did we see more locum tenant licensure requests during this time?
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, that's the second part of your question. And the irony that we experienced in 2020 was that we had a much greater need. Alaska had a much greater need for additional nurses, additional physicians, and additional mental health providers. We issued over 300 of the expedited emergency courtesy licenses to nurses, and we issued several hundred more of other license types between physicians and our four mental health programs. And the irony of that is that when people need the help most, when we don't have the ability to meet the need in Alaska because we either don't have the volume of nurses, which we don't. We have over 600 vacancies in nursing positions already in the state pre-COVID. And then we added 300 more nurses to that in 2020 because of COVID. We have specialties that were not available, physician specialties that were not available because the physicians themselves, either just like nurses, were either affected by COVID personally and they couldn't go to work, or they had to travel down south to take care of family members, or they were a close contact. So there were a variety of reasons why COVID affected our healthcare institutions and our healthcare workforce so dramatically. We're already depressed as a healthcare system in Alaska because of the need for more healthcare providers and more nurses, and we felt that last year. The issue with licensing, as you all know, is that it's a pass-through, and you have to meet the legal requirements in order to get that document that allows you to legally work. So when we have a greater need and the need is pressing and we are getting calls, I had emails and calls all day long from CEOs, from chief nursing officers, from people saying, we need this person licensed tomorrow. And our staff is not built for that. We are not structured for that. And so our staff worked, they're amazing, and they worked incredibly hard, but it's still a matter of volume. And so it took a long time, and there were quite a few delays, and we all worked together to try to get there. But that, again, is another case for the Nurse Licensure Compact, which is not the bill in front of you today, but it does speak to the need for more statutory streamlining, which, again, is what this bill would work toward, and is why the governor proposed this legislation last year to try to get ahead of it. So hopefully that answers your question, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Sarah. And something you mentioned, half of the licenses are managed by boards and half by the department, and that the boards themselves can actually pass regulations for a temporary license, but for a variety of reasons they haven't, and that this bill would provide that power or that authority directly to the department. And you see that as something that is would be helpful to have. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think that would be very helpful, and I want to be very clear, very transparent in that statement that we work closely with our boards. We work really hard to develop strong partnerships with our boards and our commission, and we would be working with them to ensure that that high public safety standards and reviews were being done, and that there wouldn't be any degradation of quality through streamlining this administrative process. So that's a message I have been carrying forward with our boards in our biweekly board chairs meetings and at their meetings, and really wanted the committee to know that if a streamlining, administrative streamlining measure like this were to be in place, that we would continue to work with our boards to make sure that those standards were in place. But the final resting point would be with the department to make sure that it got done quickly and efficiently.
Thank you. Sarah, did the board spend quite a bit of time coming up with COVID protocol? Is that what a lot of their attention was focused on this past year?
Yes, Madam Chair. Our board members, who were all volunteers, worked incredibly hard, long hours, almost full-time jobs, especially for the medical board and the Board of Nursing and some of our mental health boards, to deal with myriad of issues, because they not only are governing the licensing process and the licensing requirements, but they also govern the scope of practice for those professions in the state. And so the practice of nursing, the practice of medicine, the practice of counseling, it all rests with our boards. So they spent quite a bit of time trying to manage the various COVID-related issues that came up to strike the balance that you mentioned, which we call right touch regulation, that balance between getting people to work and that economic factor and protecting public safety. And with that added overlay of COVID, it was under a new set of healthcare delivery circumstances. So our boards work to enhance their telehealth opportunities. They were able to change their continuing education requirements to allow for more virtual classes when perhaps they didn't allow for those pre-COVID. Just a variety of changes that COVID hit, they worked really hard to change and update.
Thank you, Sarah. I have one final question before I want to open it up again, just ask if other members have questions. In the sectional, as Katie went through it, many of the changes are altering temporary license to temporary supervised practice license. Could you talk about that? I mean, is that essentially changing from a person practicing with a temporary license to a person practicing with the supervision and the oversight of a licensed Alaskan? Is that what's happening in that switch to that new language?
Madam Chair, not being the author of the bill, I'm not sure what the intent was, but it does look like that's the outcome of the bill would be that the department would be able to issue a temporary license, but the board would retain the ability to issue a supervised practice license, which boards often use to allow somebody who's sort of in a journey level phase or a student level phase of their work to start working, but they have someone who is fully licensed that they report to. So that would be new in certain areas, and would be glad to work with your staff to learn more about the intent behind it.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Do members of the committee have questions for Sarah? Senator Gray Jackson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Sarah, for this very informational comments that you made. And you said that there were 600 nursing vacancies. What's the status with CNAs?
Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson, that's another data point that we'll be glad to follow up with you to get. We know that we have known for a long time that we need more CNAs in Alaska, certified nursing assistants, and that license type is governed by the Board of Nursing. And in fact, just this week, the board adopted some emergency regulations that would help CNA programs bolster their ability to recruit and retain faculty for those programs, and intend for those regulations to be made permanent. So it's a very contemporaneous topic, and we'll be glad to see if we can get the data on the deficit of CNAs to you if we can locate that.
Thank you. Madam Chair, can I just follow up one quick question? Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So how many hours are required for certification for CNAs?
Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson, I don't know that off the top of my head, but we can find that out for you as well.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Sarah. I really appreciate your time, and I appreciate you being willing to provide some answers to the committee that were brought up in the questions today. And my office certainly will be reaching out with you just to go over this even more. I wanted to thank the members of the committee and also for the previous bill for those folks who made themselves available to answer questions. So our next meeting is Friday, February 26th at 1:30. We will have bills previously heard in the committee. That there will be no new bills at that time. So with that, we are adjourned.